Ah, Venice. So romantic. Why couldn't my husband be here again, Latimer?
You know what he's like, Mum. He got lost once in his own house. He's probably gone to the other Venice.
There's only the one Venice, Latimer.
Yes, Mum.
Are you sure it's safe to use this artifact when I take tea with my guest? It's very powerful.
I cannot foresee any problems whatsoever, Mum.
Marvellous. A gondola, Venice, a super powerful magical artifact. What could possibly go wrong?
Tea and Jeopardy with Emma Newman.
There's always time for a nice cup of tea and a spot of mild peril. Well, hello there, my lovelies. I do hope you're well and haven't had the new season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. spoiled by those lucky souls who live in America. I'm Emma Newman, and I'd like to welcome you into my secret tea bear for polite conversation, abject geekery, a cheeky bit of cake, and, of course, a nice cup of tea. So here we are in the very lovely Venice. We hired the largest gondola that we could, but it is a bit of a squeeze, so if you could tuck your elbows in, that would be marvellous. I would advise against standing up suddenly if you're at the edges, otherwise we might start rocking, and I would hate for anyone to feel queasy. Over there you can see the gorgeous Doge's Palace, which is well worth a visit if you have the opportunity. Once we've collected our guest, we'll take a gentle tour through the canals, taking in the Rialto, and of course, the Bridge of Sighs, because it would be rude not to.
I'm sorry to disturb you, Mum, but I see our guest has arrived at the jetty. Shall I pull alongside?
Yes, Latimer.
I took the liberty of using the time machine to collect her calling card earlier.
How considerate of you. Let's see it. Gail Carriger, fashion autocrat, people collector, and author beast. Best read with tea.
Ah, a fellow people collector. I wonder which preservative she uses.
You, Latimer, I'm sure that's not what she means. Oh, and look, the motif in the background is gorgeous.
Ah, Hail Hydra, Mum.
No, Latimer, it's an octopus. Look, it has 8 legs, and there's a different thing held in each one. Shoes, a quill, a teacup, a parasol, a fan, a ladybird, an hourglass, and a book. Ah, here's the jetty.
I'll just help Miss Carriger on board, Mum.
For those of you who don't know, Gail Carriger is a New York Times best-selling author of comedic steampunk mixed with urbane fantasy. Her debut novel, Soulless, won the ALA's Alex Award. And the rest of the Parasol Protectorate series is simply wonderful, too.
Miss Gail Carriger, Mum.
Hello, Gail. Do come and sit down. How are you?
Hello. Thank you for having me in your boat.
You're most welcome. Would you care for some tea?
Yes, please. I would love some tea.
And how do you take it?
I take it quite strong, strong enough for a mouse to run across, with milk, please.
Ah, yes, yes. The perfect way, in other words.
Absolutely.
I will pour. Now, would you like some cake?
Yes, I would, please.
Now, usually I know what type of cake it's going to be because Latimer bakes it in the morning, but today we're going to have some different kind of cake. Now, this is a little unusual, but Latimer and I have just recovered a magical artifact from the vaults of a distant relative of his.
How exciting.
It is, rather. It's called the Cake Stand of Plenty, and if I just remove this cloth over here, there you can see it in its crystal glory.
Ooh.
Now, it looks just like a cake stand, but according to the myth, if I polish the crystal and count to 3, and if we all shut our eyes, a cake good enough for heroes will appear. I'm really not very certain it's going to happen. Shall we try?
Absolutely.
All right, right. Okay, everyone, close your eyes. 1, 2, 3. Oh my goodness, there's a cake. Oh, look at that. That's amazing. I think that's a red velvet cake.
Oh.
Oh, would you like a slice?
I would love a slice. It feels a little risky, but, you know, it worked for Alice.
Yes, are you sure this is safe, Latimer?
Quite certain, Mum.
Well, let's give it a go. I'll take the first
mouthful, and if nothing terrible happens to me, then we'll know that you'll be fine. How about that?
Okay.
Well, here we go. Oh, no, it's lovely. It's delicious. It's fine.
All right. I will try mine. Very tasty.
Yes, this is quite pleasant. So, don't mind the chickens. They're safe in their little travelling coop at the far end. If you're wondering what those little noises were coming from, those are my chickens in there.
Aw, they're quite sweet.
They are. On a good day, yes. Now, in my invitation, I asked you to bring a curio with you. What have you decided to bring today?
I have brought my totem animal, which is a squeaky rubber octopus named Wilberforce Percival Mummy III.
Oh, my goodness, he is gorgeous.
Yes, he's a little faded and old. He's been around quite a while, but he still squeaks. So that's the important part.
On your calling card, we noticed that you had an octopus on there as well. What is it about the octopus that fascinates you so?
Ooh, well, I think they're terribly, terribly smart animals, and I'm fascinated by all of those arms, and I like the way that they can sort of, you know, squirt ink and do all sorts of crazy things. They're super smart, you know. They can do shape matching games, but they're also horribly messy. So, and then of course the most important part, and we'll put Wilberforce away. But they're also really tasty. They're quite delicious, actually. So.
Ah, yeah. He sounds quite distressed.
Sorry, Wilberforce, you weren't meant to hear it.
Did you see the video of the octopus unscrewing the lid of the jar that it's inside?
Oh, my God, it's so, yeah, absolutely fascinating. They are really remarkable, remarkable creatures. And the one with the one that hides underneath the coconuts that fall into the water.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, that's so cute. A whole bunch of octopi in this near tropical island have figured out how to disguise themselves under half coconuts and crawl along the floor on sandy beaches and then hide under a coconut and then surprise octopus. Yeah.
Wow. That is so wonderful. I'm going to have to go and find that now. So etiquette is something that we both hold dear to our hearts.
Absolutely.
Not just octopi.
Yes.
And we like to play with that in the things that we write. I was wondering what your favourite rule of etiquette is that you've uncovered in previous research or acquired through other means.
Oh, gosh, that's a difficult one. So many are so good. Went through a phase, which I haven't managed to use in my books, of being very fascinated with calling cards and the size of different calling cards. And apparently it was very gauche for a lady to send a calling card that was too big or too small, because there was a phase where women of the night and mistresses used a larger size calling card because that was cheaper or something. I don't know the reasoning. And so respectable ladies had to have cards that were a very specific size. So I love that. And then there's different meanings if you, like, turn down the corner, and there's special French or Latin phrases you're supposed to put on them if you're going out of town, and all sorts of rules and regulations, which, of course, I'm delighted by.
Yes, absolutely. I think that these things are even more delightful when we don't have to abide by them in our modern everyday life.
Although I suppose we have all sorts of strange, and like I have a whole blog post which I do about Twitter etiquette and you know, like all of these weird rules I find myself following, but I was like, I get really mad if somebody else doesn't follow those rules, and I suppose they're just as arbitrary and specific.
Yes, you're absolutely right. I've never thought about that, and I too get very upset, especially with auto DM.
Oh, that was a little... Yes. Oh,
how rude.
How rude. Or somebody who DMs you a multiple-stage conversation, because, of course, you then read it backwards, and I'm like, this is the point at which you should be emailing me these things. And of course, I have no reason to get as annoyed as I do, but the DM thing. Oh, I shake my tiny fist. It gets me so mad.
Now, moving on from things that make us
yes,
very, very angry.
That's not polite conversation.
Let's move on to more lovely things. And one of the things that I most enjoy in your various types of blog posts are the current and retro fashions.
Oh, great.
I love those. I love those posts. Now, as a fashion autocrat, I have a question for you. When one is fighting off the minions of a crazed supervillain in an epic battle for the future of humanity, which accessory do you think it's most important to get right?
Well, I think shoes... yes, I think shoes are very important. In fact, I was watching an end episode of the Chuck series, which it did jump the shark a little bit, but I was watching it, and she has this sort of last epic battle where she's wearing these platform heels, and she's battling the bad guy, and I was very upset, and I love me a platform heel, but it was just the wrong shoe for that situation, and then slightly later she jumps out of a helicopter, lands in the water, and then walks out onto a beach, and she is wearing flats, and she never changed her shoes. And it was most upsetting. I was hypnotized by the error inherent in those shoes. So shoes, definitely.
Is there, in your opinion, ever a social situation in which presenting a small puppy is not appropriate?
Well, any encounter with me would probably be. It's not that I don't like them intellectually. I'm not a fan of the slobber inherent in most dog encounters. So. That would be any time wherein, you know, enthusiasm and slobber would be frowned upon, I suppose, would be my answer to that. It has its place, enthusiasm and slobber, but that's mostly the bedroom.
Oh my goodness, the mental images I have now. What about a small kitten?
Oh yes, kittens definitely, any time. I think... Yes, I can't imagine a time when a kitten would be inappropriate, except, of course, when someone's allergic to or abhors cats, which I understand happens, but I can't really envision.
If perhaps a small kitten would be inappropriate in exactly the same situation in which enthusiasm and slobber would be appropriate in the bedroom. No, I shouldn't go there.
Yes.
So.
Yeah, sorry, we derailed.
Yes, reining myself back into polite conversation.
Our horse is shocked by our...
I'm shocked. I'm going to lie in bed this evening and replay this conversation with my wife and think, oh Emma, what did you do? But anyway, I know that you are an archaeologist.
I think I technically was an archaeologist. I'm now a full-time author, but yes. I mean, I think of myself as one often.
What was it that first drew you to the discipline of archaeology?
I can never remember a time when I wasn't, and one of my very earliest childhood memories is actually running up the garden path, and I can hear the sound of the gravel in my head, having just excavated a bone from the compost pile, which I am utterly convinced, it still has like meat attached to it, you know, it's like three dinners ago, and I'm convinced it's a dinosaur bone. And I must have been, you know, just able to run, so I must have been quite young. But so I've always been fascinated. I like the idea of sort of physically touching the past, since I've always loved history.
Did you have an area or time period that you had a specialism in?
I'm what's called a materials specialist, which is I'm actually a scientist. My degree is a master's of science degree, and so I focus on ceramic analysis. So I did a lot of lab work. It's actually a really fun form of archaeology to be a materials expert, because you get called into different parts of the world if it touches on your area of expertise. And also, you don't have to just confine yourself to working during the several months of excavation during the summer. So I go to the field and excavate, and then I can go home and continue to do research work on the artifacts. So that's kind of, it's sort of the best way to combine museum work and archaeological work, where you get to not only dig stuff up, but also look at the things very closely after they've been dug up. I'm also a potter. That's my art form of choice. And so when I first started excavating as an undergraduate, they discovered that I had this innate ability to sort of recognize and categorize ceramics because I know how they're made. And then I discovered that that's a way better job than waking up at the crack of dawn and excavating out in the field and getting all mucky and dirty. It's much, much more exciting to be part of the on-site lab. Yeah, so I've been to various different parts of the world. I've done some Romano-British stuff in England. I did one of my thesis on a now defunct site due to urban sprawl and unfortunate politics in Raqqa, Syria. I know. And then my final site that I worked with was a site called Chocopuccio, which is near Cusco in the Peruvian highlands.
Oh, wow.
And that was a marvelous, marvelous site. And that's kind of the
the one I missed a little bit.
Yeah, that sounds like proper adventure material in the real world.
It really was, yeah. It was it was really a fantastic place to go, just from a cultural perspective. And of course, that's the other marvelous thing about being an archaeologist, is you get to travel to these fabulous parts of the world and actually stay there and immerse yourself in the local culture for an extended period of time, which is something that even if you could afford to travel a lot as a tourist, it's not the same experience, because you often end up living with families or at least in hostels or camping, and you have to integrate pretty closely to the community because you're using locals to help with the processing and working and that sort of thing. So it's really fun, and of course that spears one of my other passions, which is eating the most bizarre local food I can possibly get my hands on. So,
well, now I have to know, what is the most bizarre thing you have ever eaten whilst out in the field?
Well, I am a huge fan of alpaca, and I always say if you ever have an opportunity to eat it, I highly, highly recommend alpaca. It's delicious. It's really fabulous meat. It's really good.
Really?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of like the sort of Kobe beef of the pork world. It's super tender and it's more pork tasting than it is. Yeah. But it has a sort of wild, almost slight gaminess quality to it, because alpacas, at least in the highlands, roam all over the place. They're not penned. Yeah, it's delicious.
I had no idea that they could be eaten. I feel quite sure.
Well, I should say that llamas are not so tasty. They're quite a bit gamier. The alpaca is really, I don't know about vicuna, I don't know about or camel, but I'm one of those people who will sit down in a restaurant anywhere in the world and glance down the menu and be like, what's the thing I've never had before? Recently when I was traveling in France, the waiter kept saying, does she know what she's ordering? The crazy American girl would be, I want the sweetbreads, you know? yeah.
Yes. Now, I'm not surprised you said that about llamas, because I am just rather suspicious of them in general. I'm not surprised they don't taste very good.
Yeah, they're very deeply suspicious creatures. You're wise to be wary.
Very strange things. Mm-hmm. So now you're a full-time author.
I am.
And all of the joys that go with that. And I understand that the third finishing school book is out very soon, is that right?
Yes.
Waistcoats of Weaponry.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's out at the beginning of November on the 4th. And I'm having possibly too much fun, like, on the fashion blog, which we referenced earlier, talking about, like, how I use and describe clothing as insight to character and foreshadowing and, you know, all sorts of, you know, stuff like that. I might get a little more excited about writing in the blogosphere than I do writing the latest novel.
Well, I think it's perfectly understandable given the subject matter. It is all deeply fascinating. As a fellow clothing geek, I totally, totally understand.
Yeah, it really is.
So for those listeners who may be more familiar with the Parasol Protectorate series, what could you tell us about the Finishing School series?
Well, I can tell you that it's in the same world, and that some familiar characters will pop up, because some familiar characters will pop up no matter what I try and do about it. But it's set earlier in time, so it does tie into some of the things, little clues that I dropped in the Parasol Protectorate books about what has happened in the past, about mostly focused on the steampunk elements and the steampunk technology in my universe. And so that's how they tie together, but it's a different set of main characters, and it's all about a girls' finishing school, which I've always been fascinated by the idea of finishing schools, but I wanted to write one that touched on all the things you might be taught in a finishing school, but that was actually training for spies and assassins who are ladies who are infiltrating high society. So it both teaches you perfect manners, but also how to manipulate society and class structures in order to disguise things or hide things, but also how to, you know, kind of get what you want. So I'm having a grand old time with it.
Yes, yes. I mean, really, what's not to love?
That's what I thought. I was like, this is the book that when I was 10, I wanted to read so badly.
Something I like to ask all of my friends that I take tea with is if you could pick a song which you feel expresses the theme tune of your life, as it were, what would it be?
Oh, it would have to be Cup of Brown Joy by Professor Elemental.
Ah, the dear professor!
Yes, absolutely.
That is just a fantastic song. I love that song so much. So the reason I ask is because I like to challenge my chickens and see if they know this. But in fact, this one, it isn't much of a challenge because we play it so often at home. I'm not sure. they will know this, undoubtedly. Little Chickens, Cup of Brown Joy by Professor Elemental. And there they go. Well, yes, there you are, the theme tune of your life, chickenized.
Perfect. Both Wilberforce and I are quite charmed. Quite charmed.
Now, let's have a look. Oh dear, I'm afraid that the teapot is empty.
Oh, how sad.
It is so sad.
There is no greater tragedy.
I must prevail upon you for something. I hope you don't mind. It's dreadfully rude to invite somebody to take tea and then ask them for a favour afterwards, but
oh.
I'm in a little bit of a bind. The wonderful cake stand that I demonstrated to you, it seems that there are some individuals who want to steal it from us.
Shocking!
I know, and I'm really, really quite concerned that it might fall into the wrong hands. Could I possibly trouble you just to look after it for a day or two?
Oh, I would be delighted.
And then perhaps we can throw them off the scent and Latimer and I can leave Venice and hopefully they'll follow us and the cake stand will be safe. And then at some point in the future we can make sure that we get it back again. How does that sound?
That sounds perfectly topping. I look forward to having a cake stand of plenty in my life for a short while.
Marvellous. Well, apparently it makes one cake a day.
Oh, all right.
You won't be without cake during your stewardship, at least. That's very kind of you. I'll have Latimer wrap it, and we do have a nice small crate, I hasten to add, that is very robust for travelling, so it should be quite safe in there. That leaves me to say it's been such a delight.
Thank you so much. It has been a pleasure to visit with you.
Yes, and thank you so much for taking the trouble to fly all the way to Venice.
Oh, it's torturous.
And I do hope that we will run into each other at some point next year, hopefully, during various conventions.
Absolutely. I look forward to it.
Lovely. Well, do take care. We'll just pull up to this jetty and you can hop off. There's another gondola that we've arranged for you to get straight into to take you on to wherever you wish to go.
All righty then. Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care.
You too. Bye. Bye.
Don't look so worried, Latimer. If anyone will take good care of a magical cake stand, it's Gale. It will be quite safe.
I have every faith in Miss Carragher, ma'am. It's her gondolier that concerns me. He doesn't seem to be very good at his job.
Oh, it looks like it's his first day. Why has he changed direction? I'm sure Gale pointed the other way.
Oh, dear. Note the goatee, ma'am.
It's Christoph Adam! For those of you who don't know, he's the head of the Anti-Cake League, Adam Christopher's evil future self. This is a disaster. The ones following us earlier must have been Anti-Cake Leaguers. We fell right into their trap.
It seems Miss Carragher is not willing to hand over the cake stand.
She's trying to reason with him. She's being so polite, even though he's tried to grab that cake stand crate very rudely. I'm not sure I could be.
Much as I agree with Miss Carragher's adherence to good manners, it isn't working.
I'd throw this oar, but there's a chance I could knock off her hat, and that would never do. Oh, she's got Wilberforce. Surely even Christoph Adam is powerless against its little squeaks.
I fear a man who has turned his heart against cakes would be immune to such things.
Oh, you're right, Latimer. Look at the cold set of his jaw. And to think the Adam Christopher I know now is just so lovely and totally harmless. Oh, Latimer, what have we done?
Miss Carragher is taking off her shoe. I did notice the particularly sharp heel earlier.
It does look quite deadly. I think she's going to throw it.
Nothing like a good shoe to the face when one is in a bind. Did I tell you about the time that a particularly fine set of leather brogues saved me from...
Ooh, good shot. He fell in the water and now Gale's got the oar. Can you see him? He may be anti-cake, but I can't let a man drown.
I can't see him anywhere, ma'am.
Do you think that's the last we'll see of him?
No. These gentlemen have a habit of coming back. Usually, when one least expects them.
Well, at least Gale and the cake stand of plenty are safe. While Fatima keeps an eye out for Christoph Adam, I'd like to mention our very own Patreon page, where you can become a member of the Order of the Sacred Teacup. Should you wish to join the Order and discover how Latimer became my butler, go to www.patreon.com/TeaAndJeopardy. We've just added a couple of new milestones. Speaking of the Order, I'd like to raise my teacup to Dithayori Grimsdottir and David Mason. Oh, and that reminds me, I had a lovely message from Ron Davis, a member of the Order. I thought you might like to hear it, Latimer. He says, "It was wonderful to meet you and Latimer while I sojourned in the UK this summer. I especially enjoyed my long talk with Latimer about my plans to split the United Kingdom. Next time I will be more careful about sharing my machinations. I should have realized the power of the Butler Brotherhood. I now must return to the laboratory to finish my design for a tea-sensing hat. As always, may the sacred order of the teacup never cease to pour. Ron." Oh, that's lovely. The Butler Brotherhood, Latimer. I've never heard of it.
The first rule of the Butler Brotherhood is to never put off polishing the silver. The second rule is to never talk about the Butler Brotherhood.
Oh, Latimer, that Hail Hydra earlier was just a joke, wasn't it? Because we watched Captain America 2 again last night, right?
A joke, Mum? Yes, of course.
Find us a new location for the tea lair, Latimer. Preferably one that doesn't require oars.
Very good, Mum.
You've just listened to an episode of Tea and Jeopardy, hosted by Emma Newman. Go to www.teaandjeopardy.com to find out more and join in.